Let's talk about a team that, in my view, deserves credit, but for the fact that we have the worst recovery in the history of recessions in this country, and that's the central planners that are running, trying to run our economy. By the way, I heard you on Tom Wood's show. I thought you did a good job.
Well, thank you very much. We discussed the old skyscraper curse, which we need to talk about on this show sometime in the future.
Well, why don't you go ahead and do that now?
Sure. What Tom and I discussed was my research on the skyscraper curse, which is a correlation between the building of a world's record-setting skyscraper somewhere around the world and a world economic crisis. And those two things have coincided over the last 100 years. If you look at the Panic of 1907, you look at the Great Depression, when there were three record-setting skyscrapers, concluding with the Empire State Building. And then you go to the stagflation of the 1970s, and you had World Trade Tower 1 and 2 and the Sears Building setting world records. And what happened after that was, of course, the breakdown of the Bretton Woods system, the U.S. going off the gold standard, 12 years of high unemployment and high inflation, including gasoline shortages and all the rest. And then more recently in times, you had the Taipei 101 and with the tech bubble setting a record in Taiwan. And then more recently than that, with the housing bubble, you had the Dubai Khalif Towers in Dubai of the United Arab Emirates setting a world's record by a long margin. Actually, in 2007. And basically, we were able to call the housing bubble and the top in the housing market using that indicator. The record was set in 2006, but the building didn't actually open up to the public until January of 2010. And so we knew in advance that the housing bubble would collapse, and we projected that the world would be in an economic crisis before the building actually opened, because it was actually so tall that the construction continued long after the record height was actually reached. And so we were in a good position to know that the housing bubble that we had seen here at the Mises Institute and published several articles about it, that it was would soon come to an end. And so, you know, that the coincidence is not just a coincidence. It's when I first heard of the skyscraper curse back in 1999, I immediately saw the Austrian business cycle theory in action, because, you know, the Austrian business cycle theory teaches that when the central banks lowered the interest rate below the market level of interest rates and holds that interest rate low for a long extended period of time, what it does is it sends the information, the wrong information, to entrepreneurs to build, you know, the wrong things. And they tend to build long range investment projects that pay off over a very long period of time. And that's what that low interest rate does, is it sends a signal to entrepreneurs that you can start building now for a very long run future, because apparently savings are abundant in the economy. And so, you know, you get the low interest rates, you get a boom in the economy, which, you know, where everybody's making money. It causes speculative behavior beyond normal levels, and so you get these projects started in all areas of the economy, but in skyscrapers as well. And so what we've seen in the aftermath of the housing bubble is that governments have returned again to these low interest rate policies. Central banks have reduced interest rates to near zero in most of the major economies of the world. Indeed, we're in a world currency war where everybody is trying to reduce interest rates and keep their currency low. And so it's not surprising that skyscraper building is a very popular behavior now. And so there are record-setting skyscrapers in process here in the United States, in New York City. They just set a world record in China. And, of course, a couple of years ago, they set a world record in Europe with the Shard building in London, England, which sort of gave us an indicator that there would be trouble in Europe, and, of course, there was. And right now, the Chinese government is trying to prevent a company over there from building a world record-setting skyscraper. And so we're sort of waiting to see how that all turns out. But given the fact that there's records in the U.S. and in Europe and in China already, we can pretty much presume that there's economic trouble ahead, and especially that will be confirmed if the Chinese go ahead and set yet another new world record in terms of skyscrapers.
Now, is this just purely coincidental, the skyscraper curse?
Well, I think that's, you know, when the guy, Andrew Lawrence, released his report in 1999, that's how people took it. They sort of laughed it off. They said, you know, this is like who wins the Super Bowl, or, you know, the January effect, or the Christmas Santa Claus rally, or, you know, these kind of incidental sort of indicators that don't have any basis in economic rationality. But I think the skyscraper curse or indicator is based in reality because, as I said, I saw the Austrian theory of the business cycle in it immediately. You know, business cycles are all about real estate. They're all about too many loans in the wrong direction. And they're all about technology as well. And one of the things that I knew before I saw that report was that if you set a new world's record skyscraper, guess what? You've got to come up with all sorts of new technologies in order to make that happen, because every wire that you run from the bottom of that building to the top of that building takes up space on every floor of that building. And so you've got to come up with all new ways of doing things to account for the water and sewage that has to flow through that building. You've got to come up with all new ways of doing your elevators. You know, they've got to be faster, quicker, more technologically advanced to get from point A to point B. You've got to come up with all new ways of doing, like, your air conditioning and heating. You know, and your ductwork, for example, that has to flow through in order to set a world's record. Now you're talking about 200 stories. So if you've got a duct that takes up 1 square foot, well, that's going to have to go through all 200 stories. And so every system in a skyscraper has to be revolutionized to a certain degree. You need new efficiencies and economies in order to make that work. And indeed, I've learned recently that instead of running in skyscrapers now, instead of running ductwork to handle your air and heat, that they actually run a hose that contains the Freon that does the heating and cooling. So instead of a duct that's maybe 18 square inches with powerful fans to push air around, now they only have a tube, you know, that takes up about 1 square inch. To run the heating and air to individual units on individual floors or even individual rooms. So that's the kind of thing that has to go on to set these records. And so companies outside the skyscraper, the construction companies, the AC companies, all of that has to, they have to come up with new products. They have to come up with new factories. They have to come up with new technologies. And so they're sort of revolutionizing the way we do things. And when the false signals of the central banks are realized, all of those, it's not just the skyscraper that turns out to be a bad investment, but all of those new technologies, all of those factories, all of the training that went into making those systems also falls on hard times, along with other areas of the economy as well. Yeah.
Where do you think this economy is heading now, given what you see from a macro perspective? Are we in trouble?
I think we're in trouble. I think it's just a matter of, you know, the signal to take place. There's always a trigger mechanism that takes us from the boom to the bust. And that trigger mechanism is normally outside the realm of economic analysis. It's a factor it's basically a surprise factor, that turns, you know, cause right now everybody's wondering, you know, how can you have bad economic statistics, in the economy and yet record setting stock markets and all time high prices in bond markets. So you can have one of two things. The first thing is a basic economic cost or an economic cause, excuse me, where key, factors in the economy, basically get too high. So if interest rates were to rise and set new highs in the marketplace, that would be a trigger mechanism. If oil prices spiked to a very, very high level, revealing the fact that there's much higher costs throughout the economy, that would be an economic trigger mechanism, or it could be something, a non-economic trigger mechanism, such as a war or
earthquake.
A dispute. Yeah, just something like that, where obviously economic calculations of the future have to be revised significantly, and the underlying fundamentals are revealed to be much more negative than they had first appeared to be. And so, you know, with a world currency war going on, things never end good from a world currency war. Things ultimately are going to turn much, much more negative. You know, the statistics are, if you look at CNBC or Fox Business News, every report that the government puts out has got a positive spin to it. And the reality is that those reports should be dressed down, basically, and shown to be much more negative. And, you know, given the fact that, you know, this crisis that we're in started in 2007, the government has unleashed unprecedented policies to combat it, and yet they really haven't worked to the degree that they're supposed to, or to the degree that they were promised to. And on top of that, we've added a huge government debt problem, and which is perceived in other countries as a fiscal crisis. In our country, it's not even talked about as a fiscal crisis when it really should be. And so that's what we're looking for. We're just looking for the ultimate trigger mechanisms.
That could
have happened today. It could have happened a month ago. It could happen next month. That's something that Austrian economics can't answer.
Well, what I was going to say is that couldn't the policies, you and I both recognize that the stated objective of this money printing clearly hasn't worked. And for them to continue to print and print and print in the face of overwhelming empirical data that it's not working, could it be, as some argue, that they're just using the cover of a weak economy to accomplish some other objective? I mean, for example, I wish somebody would ask Bernanke, well, if things are so much better, what are you so afraid of that makes you continue to debase our currency?
Well, that's a very good question, Alan. And, you know, they're afraid of the fact that if they're not printing, if they're not using quantitative easing, if they're not buying up the government bonds, that the interest rate on bonds would be much, much higher than it actually is. I mean, I think the current estimate is that the central bank, the Federal Reserve, is buying up 60% of government debt. And so if they were to stop that process, everyone can imagine because the international market for U.S. government debt is basically drying up. And so you can imagine if the Fed were to move away from buying U.S. treasuries, that the interest rate would rise precipitously. And, of course, that would, you know, the interest rate on government bonds and it is tied into all interest rates. And so the interest rate for everyone would rise in response. And that's, you know, that's one of the reasons why Austrians caution against this kind of policy, because if the government borrows too much money and causes interest rates to rise, of course, that hurts the economy, but it actually, it creates a public clamor against the Congress spending money and against the Congress borrowing money. And, you know, it increases their willingness to try to balance the budget. I mean, let's not forget that Ross Perot ran as a third-party candidate for president against the first governor, Bush and Clinton, and he wanted the country, basically he didn't have an elaborate agenda. I mean, he basically wanted the government to balance its budget. And when he took a significant share of the vote and ultimately decided the election, you know, guess what happened? Congress and the president started working towards a balanced budget. And within 8 years, the Congress had whittled away the deficit down to zero, and we were actually running a surplus. So the fact that Ben Bernanke has stepped in on behalf of the large New York City banks is very much, I mean, he very much holds the responsibility for adding $5 trillion to the U.S. National debt. That's basically on his watch what happened. And, you know, I know he'll never own up to that, but even though he's an economist, he'll eventually be able to figure out the cause and effect of what his actions have allowed to take place. Basically, the gold standard was the reason why the U.S. government always had a balanced budget, except in times of war. And, you know, so the central bank policy of bailing out the government and monetizing the debt is basically Bernanke's doing. And if he hadn't engaged in this reckless, unprecedented monetary policy of zero interest rates and quantitative easing, Operation Twist, on and on and on, this crisis would have been over.
You know, I was going to tell you, John Williams at Shadow Stats keeps track of the Fed's treasury buying, and Ben Bernanke's actually been buying now over 100% of the net new treasuries that have been issued so far this year. And he comes to that by the level of treasuries that they're buying is exceeding the level of new treasuries. So he's buying not only everything that's being sold now, but he's buying stuff that was sold in prior to the beginning of the year.
Yes, of course, because I mean the deficit is, let's say, $1 trillion, but you've also got an additional $16+ trillion of national debt that has to be rolled over each year, and so every month, you know, they have to redeem a huge amount of existing debt, existing national debt. So the deficit is nothing but new debt that's being added to the old debt. But so the amount that comes onto market exceeds the amount of new debt reflected in the deficit by a substantial number. And that's why I think the last number I heard was they're buying up 60% of all of the debt. So that would make the fact that they're buying up $1 trillion of new debt and $1 trillion of debt or so that is being rolled over from previous years. And of course, most of that national debt has occurred within the last two administrations, the Bush administration, there was a huge increase in the debt, and then, of course, in the Obama administration, there's been an escalation in the amount of debt. And so a lot of that has occurred in recent times. And I think most of the portfolio of the Fed is that they've been buying up a lot of long-range debt, whereas traditionally they bought only short-term debt.
How long can a nation like the United States fully monetize all of its debt and its currency survive as the way you and I would think it was would survive? I mean, clearly the purchasing power of the dollar falls practically every day, but how long realistically can we keep up this full-scale dollar debasement without it eventually just collapsing on itself?
Well, Alan, the conventional wisdom is that once a country's national debt reaches the same level as its gross domestic product, that it's in serious trouble, and that countries have survived, you know, less than 100%, and they've been able to back away from that. But it seems like that once you get past 100%, it becomes politically very difficult to work your way out of that politically, because it means that basically in order to back yourself out of that, you've got to cut government expenditures without increasing taxes. And politically, that's typically not a winning strategy. And as a result, the tendency is for short-term oriented politicians to want to spend your way out of the problem, to try to spend your way to economic growth. And, of course, we know that doesn't work. It only adds to the future obligations. And so countries eventually turn towards monetizing the debt. And if, as that drives up prices, the demand to hold money decreases. And so people start spending their money much quicker. They don't want to hold cash balances. But that only adds to the upper movement in prices and the debasement of the currency. And ultimately, of course, especially in smaller economies, you can see this devolve into a hyperinflation.
Do you think that we might see a hyperinflation here?
Well, you know, the dollar, as bad as it is still not terrible versus other countries. And so our currency, such as it is not the worst currency in the world. And so obviously currencies such as the Norwegian kroner or the Swiss franc, you know, those are higher quality currencies than the U.S. dollar. But I'd have to say the U.S. dollar is of a higher quality than the euro or the yen. And so in a global system with a global currency war going on, I would expect other currencies to actually fail before the U.S. currency. And of course, if there was a currency that, to fail, if the euro were to somehow unwind itself, for example, or for the Japanese yen to plummet in value, in line with their recent policies, I think that that would set off, that would be one of those possible trigger mechanisms that we talked about earlier that would reignite the world economic crisis. But, you know, anything is possible in the U.S. dollar and the U.S. debt. Looking forward to the massive unfunded liabilities of Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, and other programs and other obligations, yes. That if that is not addressed, and the U.S. If our Federal Reserve were to try to monetize those obligations over the next couple decades, that would spell hyperinflation, where basically your currency is depreciating so fast that you don't know what the prices are going to be when you show up at the stores. And you're not even sure if there will be goods on the shelves.
With all of the economists being educated in the same schools, taught out of the same textbooks, basically from administration to administration, all we get are Keynesians. And as a result, from an economic perspective, it matters little who we elect because we're going to get Keynesianism. Is that an overly harsh assessment?
Well, you're basically going to get the same type of economist. Republicans will pick people that have, you know, some credentials with respect to their party. Ben Bernanke was a Republican, is a Republican, although when asked, Paul Krugman was surprised to hear that, even though they were on the same faculty at Princeton. So there's, you know, as the former governor of Alabama, George Wallace, said, there's not a dime's worth of difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. They're basically of the same faith economically. And really, the differences are not in terms of economic policies at all. I mean, the Republicans have been much worse in recent years, in recent administrations, than the Democrats on a variety of economic issues. So that Reagan, for example, was willing to, you know, use massive deficit spending, whereas Jimmy Carter did a lot of good policies in terms of deregulating industries that have benefited Americans tremendously. I mean, most people probably don't remember it, but before Jimmy Carter started deregulating utilities, you know, you could be paying 30 cents a minute for long distance calls. And so you really have to look carefully at what these administrations are doing, but by and large, the elite economist of the Ivy League from which these Democrats and Republican administrations pull their, you know, the chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, the Treasury Secretary, and the chairman of the Federal Reserve, they're all of the same stripe, basically. They all have this Keynesian orientation. You know, so Janet Yellen, who is Ben Bernanke's replacement, is of the same school of economic thought. And, you know, they don't really know what they're doing. They're both, for example, have made tremendous, you know, the advocates of creating more government money. Well, at the same time, they're both in favor of putting constraints on government, constraints on bank lending, which is one of the primary reasons why the economy has been so stagnant, is that the banks have been facing severe regulation and sharp increases in their capital allocations. And so they really both don't know what they're doing on a variety of issues. And, you know, so they're, you're not going to get much of a different point of view that whether you have a Republican administration or a Democratic administration. And it's not just in monetary policy, of course, where everybody seems to agree that, you know, with everybody else, that what we're doing right now that I think is insanity, and I think you concur, but it's also true in other areas of the economy in terms of fiscal policy and regulatory policy. There's no difference of opinion, basically, between the Republicans and the Democrats and the economists that they choose. And that's the reason why I think Americans need to educate themselves. You know, you need to go to Mises.org and get a different point of view and assess the differences between the Austrian economist and the Keynesians. And you need to come to programs like yours and get information not just about the government statistics, but about the real meaning behind those government statistics and why they're tend to be short-sighted and why they tend not to be a true reflection of reality. You need alternative information to the status quo.
I don't see us getting any alternative, though. I mean, shy of a Ron Paul type candidate. It's just going to be more of the same.
Well, we're changing minds. We're changing opinions. And, you know, the Ross Perot effect that I alluded to earlier, I think is very much on the horizon. I think there's enough Americans now already who are willing to side with a third party. I note the election in Virginia where a third party candidate did in a very close race, in a very watched race, in a nationally important race where outside money was flowing, was the balance of the vote. And the fact that a Libertarian candidate was polled at more than 10% just prior to the election, I think is an indicator that there's room out there for third-party candidates to stand up and say, we want a balanced budget. We want market-determined interest rates. You know, Ross Perot was all about the deficit, but I think now the public is increasingly being educated by shows like yours that the central bank is a key source of our problem, a key source of, you know, higher prices, the source of the business cycle. And the fact that they've intervened in the housing market, in the mortgage market, and prevented the crisis from becoming curative and basically frozen us in a state of malaise, I think more and more people know that today, and we just need a voice, and we need somebody on the ticket to make that happen.
Boy, you don't see that, though, on either one of the two mainstream parties. I mean, that's it looks to me like the Fed policy, really, despite what they claim, I mean, targeting unemployment, and then he's the U3. I mean, surely they're not so dumb that they don't recognize that there is quite a distinction between the U3 and the number of people who are jobless in this country. But all he's doing, Bernanke, is using the weak economy to accomplish some other objective, i.e., to monetize the government's debt and to help his banker buddies with their systemic solvency problem. And the rest of it, you know, the economy be damned. Otherwise, how could he continue with a policy that clearly does not work?
Well, that's what he wrote his dissertation on, is that you have to bail out the big banks. And, you know, unfortunately, that's what's guiding the stock market is, you know, the central banker says he's here to bail out the big banks and to bail out Wall Street, and he's keeping interest rates at zero. So what's to prevent us from leveraging our investments and making a killing in the market? If we can get out soon enough, you know, we'll be home free, scot-free. And the real problem is not these banks, and it's not Wall Street. The real problem, as I see it, and I see it every day, is the regular, ordinary people out there in the economy that make up the vast, vast majority of people who are, you know, working part-time jobs that are below what they're qualified to do, and they're working very hard, and they're on food stamps, and they're in trouble on mortgages and various other economic concerns out there. And, you know, and Bernanke's and all the savers, all the retirees who, you know, don't want to be in risky investments. They don't want to be in tech stocks. They don't want to be in social media stocks. They want to be in safe investments. But if you put your money in so-called safe investments, and I'm not sure if there are any safe investments nowadays, your rate of return is extremely low. There's an advertisement on TV, Alan, that I know you've seen because it's about the Georgia lottery, where the husband comes in and says, "Honey, I hate to break the bad news to you, but I won the lottery today, and it was only $15 million. And the wife starts crying, saying she's going to have to, you know, cancel the cable and all that. But if you took $15 million and you put it in the bank nowadays, it would earn almost no money whatsoever. You know, think of how much money you would earn if you took $15 million and put it into a checking account. Okay. With those of you with a calculator out there, I'm not sure what that amount is, but it might be the case that a upper middle class family who won the lottery, $15 million, and they put it in their checking account, the rate of return would be so low that they would have to keep their jobs and, you know, cut back on expenses and things of that nature, because that's what Ben Bernanke has done. He's distorted our economy away from normal to extreme levels. I mean, this is totally unprecedented in history that these sorts of things have been happening, where the central bank drives down the rate of interest to zero, and the government borrows more than $1 trillion every year on an ongoing basis. That's just unacceptable, and it's irrational, and it's not going to work. And I'm afraid we're all going to have to pay a very high price for that.
To the audience, Mark and I have blown over the time allotted for the show, and we're going to have to go ahead and take a break. Hey, Mark, it's always a pleasure, my friend.
Thank you very much, Alan. I look forward to speaking with you real soon, and all your listeners, go to Mises.org.
Yeah, this is Dr. Mark Thornton, Mises.org, Mises.org. Mark, have a good week, okay, guy? Talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You too.